Professor Pauline Boss is a professor at the University of Minnesota in the College of Human Ecology. She is a PhD. She is a researcher and is widely recognized for her groundbreaking research on what's known as the theory of ambiguous loss. She joins us now from her office in the Twin Cities. Professor Boss, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
You're very welcome.
It is, I guess, even more since last Monday, a somewhat propitious time to be visiting with you. Not only are we only a few months away from the 10th anniversary of 9/11, but the person I guess most blamed or credited for that particular attack, Osama bin Laden, was assassinated by U.S. Navy SEALs. And you deal with, and you have dealt with, the loved ones of people who died in the 9/11 tragedy. And we're going to talk about that. But first, I want to talk to you about the theory of ambiguous loss. Can you give us a kind of a brief description of what that is?
Okay. Well, the idea is that the most difficult kind of loss is the kind of loss that has no closure. That is, it can't be resolved. The first kind is when people are physically missing, as they were in the World Trade Towers in the pile down at Ground Zero, when there was no evidence of death. And to this day, 1,500 of the 3,000, I think more or less, have still no evidence of or remains of their loved one. So that's an ambiguous loss that is physical, where the body is missing, and they have no body to bury. The other kind of ambiguous loss is when the mind is missing. The person is there, but they're no longer the way they used to be. For example, if they should have dementia or autism or be depressed or addicted, various examples like that. 9/11 obviously involved the former.
Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this question to be flip, but why does it matter? Isn't grief grief?
Oh, no. There is in the literature, we're learning a lot about grief now because research was done after 9/11, and Freud had some things right and some things not quite so right. And grief is not something you get over. In fact, Freud may have had it closer to right than later developers of the grief literature like Kubler-Ross, who says that if you go through five stages, you're over it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in her last book, which I recommend people read, she didn't. She said herself, it's messier than that. It took her 7 years to die because she had small strokes and had a miserable ending. So she renounced that herself, mm-hmm, toward the end of her life. I think we like steps like that because we think grief is something we can get over. And what we know now is that you live with loss. You remember your grandmother. You remember your parents. You use your grandmother's recipes. Yeah. My son wears still his grandfather's hunting coat,
mm-hmm,
and carries his gun, by the way. And I wear my sister's jewelry and so on. The door doesn't close when someone is lost. The idea of closure is a myth.
Mm. So, okay, so what you're saying then is that the, at least for a number of years, the widely accepted thought or theory of going through the, as you mentioned, the stages of grief, and finally moving past that, what you're talking about is rather dealing with and living with, mm-hmm, I guess maybe you'd call it unresolved grief.
That's right. And some of the grief is more resolved than others. I mean, if you have the body, you see the death certificate, the coroner comes and declares someone dead. That's easier than, for example, a woman I'm working with whose husband disappeared at sea, and in the state she lives, she has to wait either 5 or 7 years until she can declare him dead, and then she has to lift up the telephone and call and say, I'm now ready to declare him dead. That's also what the wives of the missing in action soldiers
right.
had to do.
Right.
And that is beyond normal human expectations.
I would think
we should not have to declare our own loved ones dead.
I would think, yes. I guess this is the first I'd ever heard of that, and I'm a Vietnam vet, so obviously there were a number of veterans that did not come back. Their families didn't know what happened, just the kind of thing that you're talking about. I didn't realize, though, that their immediate loved one were the ones that had to finally decide when
they actually were dead. Oh, they had to decide when they wanted to change their status from MIA to KIA, which is killed in action. But the wives, almost all of them said it felt like they were killing their husband when they made that phone call.
I would believe that. We're visiting with Professor Pauline Boss, professor at the University of Minnesota, who has done extensive work, extensive research, and also extensive counseling work for people dealing with ambiguous loss. You are the author of, I believe, 6 books. If I'm not mistaken, your most recent book is Loss, Trauma, and Resilience, Therapeutic Work with Ambiguous Loss. Talk a little bit, and as I understand it, or rather talk a little bit about resilience. What is it? What role does it play in working with people with this type of loss?
Well, I'm finding more and more that it's tolerance for ambiguity, and that happens to be something that in our culture we don't have very much of. We want a period at the end of a sentence. We want the end of the story. We don't like things that we can't see and our problems we can't solve. We're a can-do society, and all of that is good. I'm glad we are. We put Ben on the moon, and we cure illnesses. But now and then, there's a problem that can't be solved, and that's, for example, the ambiguous loss of 9/11, and more recently, the one I'm working on is the epidemic of dementia, where as yet there is no solution for that, the diseases that cause dementia, and so the family has to live with a loved one who's simply fading away. That is very, very hard for people who have a low tolerance for ambiguity and unanswered questions.
Mm.
And my premise is that we could learn to increase that so that we are not so distressed and immobilized by living with a problem that has no solution.
I know that you... in your books, in your latest book, you detailed 6 guidelines for resiliency, and I'm wondering if you could talk about those, and I'm assuming that these are things that you do literally work with families and loved ones of whether people that have been killed and there is no body, or as you mentioned, people with dementia. Can you talk a little bit about those guidelines?
Well, the first one was finding meaning. I mean, we have to, a loss has to make sense to us and before you can cope with it. And, for example, if a 90-year-old grandparent dies, finding meaning in that is less difficult than finding meaning, let's say, when a child dies or when you have no, you can't find the body of the person whom you loved. So finding meaning is especially hard with ambiguous loss, and we talk about how to do that. And then the second is tempering our need for mastery, for being in control.
I see.
And we have to accept the fact that the person, for example, with dementia is still here, but they're not like they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that means choosing to have a good enough relationship rather than maintaining you want perfection.
I see.
If you maintain that you want total control and perfection, the stress levels will be immense when you have an ambiguous loss. And then people either decide to say nothing is wrong here, you know, grandpa can still drive the car, or they say he's already dead to me.
I see.
And they never visit him again. And neither of those are very humane. And the more the deeper humanity is when one increases one's tolerance for ambiguity and you let go of the need for a perfect relationship. Mm-hmm. And then the third is identity, and that, of course, changes. People with loved ones don't know if they're still married. Loved ones who are missing are puzzled about, am I still married or not?
Mm-hmm.
What should I do? And then the fifth is ambivalence, where ambiguity creates ambivalence. It's just a natural outcome of it. It's not a psychiatric problem, but it's a stress problem, and we need to know that it's normal for people to wish it were over, and it's okay to act on those dark feelings. You know, I wish they were dead, then I wouldn't have to worry anymore.
Mm.
But not to act,
sure.
Not to act on those feelings, but it's okay to normalize those feelings. And the final one is hope. You have to find a new kind of hope, because the old hope is no longer viable.
Sure.
And so we encourage both and thinking, whereby you keep your relationship with the person who is ambiguously lost. You remember them, I mean, but you also then develop new relationships, new hopes and dreams, and move forward with your own life.
I want to remind our listeners, we're visiting with Professor Pauline Boss, PhD from the University of Minnesota in the College of Human Ecology, about...
By the way, it's Professor Emeritus.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Emeritus.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. It just means I'm not teaching anymore.
At any rate, you mentioned stress, and it would seem to me, although maybe I'm wrong, and that's why I'm going to ask you the question, that those people that have to deal with the ambiguous loss of somebody who is still alive, as you mentioned, the type two, if you will, there is physical presence but psychological
mm-hmm.
absence, that the stress of dealing with that relationship on an ongoing caregiver type of basis, or at least partial caregiver, would be more stressful than the type one, where the person is gone but psychologically they're still there. Is that true, or is that just that just be my popular misconception?
I don't have the answer to that, but in my clinical work, I would say they're equal. There are data for caregivers of Alzheimer's disease that say that caregivers die at a rate 63% higher than their same age group. So we need to know that caregiving is dangerous to one's health, and that's why I wrote the last book, which is coming out in August, Loving Someone Who Has Dementia.
Oh, right.
To help the caregiver take care of their stress levels.
And I realize that we're barely scratching the surface of this, but are there some things that you can talk about that caregivers can do to lessen that stress, to lessen the chances of their earlier demise?
Well, the six steps that I just went over.
Oh, okay.
That particular book I wrote for professionals, for therapists,
uh-huh.
Who are working with all kinds of ambiguous loss. And what I did was I took those six steps and added a seventh for this book, which I wrote directly for families, for the trade audience. So I tried to get rid of the jargon that
learns
in academia.
Sure.
The seventh one, obviously, is talking about taking care of themselves.
Sure.
But I pretty much talk about the good enough relationship, that ambiguity can even be good at times, and went over the different kinds of grief so they would know where they are in it, and normalized what caregivers feel, because I think many times they are inadvertently diagnosed with depression and things that make them feel as if they failed.
Oh, sure.
But in fact, most of them are suffering from unresolved grief. And depression versus unresolved grief, which would be chronic sadness, are two different things.
Mm.
One is normal and one is an illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we too often label caregivers with the label of illness, depression,
mm-hmm.
when in fact they're simply and normally sad.
Now,
that requires a different intervention.
I see. Pardon me for interrupting. I read that, I believe you made this is a statement, I believe, off your website, that 5 years, well, no, this would have been in about 1994, the idea of ambiguous loss was introduced. That's fairly recent.
74.
Oh, 74. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. 74. Yeah, I still would say that's fairly recent. Was there something that happened around that time, Professor Boss, that prompted us to look at this in a different way than we have before?
No, I was a graduate student down at Madison, the University of Wisconsin, and I was learning to do therapy, and I noticed that when the families came in, the fathers were all angry about being there, and they said, don't you know the children are mother's business, so why do you need me? Now, we have to remember that was 74. Fathers right. are much more involved today. And so I came up with the idea of psychological father absence in an intact family, but later on realized that this idea was more than about fathers. It could be anybody in the family who was there but not there. And that's where I came up with the term ambiguous loss. I coined it way back then.
Have you done, this just popped into my head, have you done any work around, and you referred to one of the things that a person suffers loss over is through addiction. Have you done any work? It was very interesting what you just said about fathers that weren't there psychologically or emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
That in connection with various types of addiction where part of the symptom of the disease is some abandonment.
Yes.
At some point
yeah.
in time.
I
can see a real connection.
Yeah, clearly, I haven't done that work myself, but others have, because the person, it could be a mother or a father or a child in the family who's addicted, they're there but not there. But there's a difference with addiction from, let's say, dementia or people who are physically missing due to war, and that is that there is such a thing as called treatment.
Right.
And so one has to know that you can't just settle with addiction in the way that you have to do so with dementia, for example, or an incurable disease, because you have that option
sure.
of going into recovery, working toward recovery,
right.
which hopefully people do.
We have been visiting with Professor Emeritus Pauline Boss of the University of Minnesota. She has done groundbreaking work on the theory of ambiguous loss. She is the author of, I think you said your next one, it will be your seventh book?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Coming out. And she has joined us from her office down in the Twin Cities. Professor Boss, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to visit with us. I wish I had twice as much time as we do. Because it's very difficult, obviously, to get in depth on a subject like this in the short time that we had. But I do very much appreciate not only being with us, but the work that you've done on this.
Well, it was my pleasure. You live in a beautiful area up there, so my thoughts are with everyone up there in beautiful North Shore.
Thank you kindly. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.